You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. .734 on the west coast of the United States, where it's going to be the hottest place on the planet today, I think. And joining me to attest to that from Southern California is Stacy Reidinger. Stacy, first of all, thanks for coming on All Marine Radio again and joining us. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's it's about 78 degrees here. We've been having temperature swings of about 40 to 50 degrees if you're inland from the coast. So we'll see how hot it gets today. A lot of the trails are closed for us, so got to go play outside either early in the morning or at night.
All right. And where you're in the San Diego area?
Yes, we're in Poway, which is about 12 miles inland. So.
All right. So it'll crack, 105 there today?
Probably so.
Nice.
Yeah, there's about 100. Today.
Yeah, good luck on those trails early in the morning. And watch out for the rattlesnakes. They like to lay out.
Oh, yeah. And the tarantulas.
All right, so we need to learn about you real quick there, Stacy. So what you're born and raised where?
So I was born and raised in Louisiana, Southern Louisiana, a little town called Morgan City. And I joined the Marine Corps.
Whoa. Just stop. Louisiana? I always find people from there very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have a whole lot in common with the United States. It's kind of its own little planet. Yes, Louisiana, they have their own little dialect and their own little crazy customs. How would you explain Louisianans to the rest of us?
I'd say if you've ever gone into a bar and everybody in there either knows you, or if they don't know you, they greet you and they say, hey, come over, have a drink. And you just kind of feel that hospitality. That's really how it explains Louisiana. Not that everybody's in a bar drinking. That does happen quite a bit. But moreover, it's just the way that I was raised was, you know, the good manners and just to say hi and to be kind and to say hello to everybody. And that's just kind of the way that I explain it. And, of course, the awesome food that we have.
Awesome,
of course, my grandmother's kitchen is the best place. But if you can't get to my grandmother's kitchen, then the next place would be some of the great restaurants we have and the little bitty, you know, pockets of Louisiana, not the big touristy areas that you might think. You really want to find those mom-and-pop joints that are one of that – that serves some spectacular food.
All right. Well, okay, that's great advice. Where did you go to college?
I went to college at the University of Colorado in Boulder, Colorado, and got my undergrad there. And then also
in what?
What'd
you study?
Oh, my. Yeah, I studied English literature and secondary education.
Oh,
so kind of felt, yeah, the education part of it was probably something I didn't realize would be as impactful as it has been in my career as a Marine. So.
Well, I'll tell you what. My advice to anybody who doesn't know what they want to do in college is become an English major. You'll be well-read, you'll be well-written, you'll be well-spoken, and you can take that and go do anything with it. But you don't see very many English lit majors, so I think that's always interesting.
Hey, you know what? Yeah, and you're actually touching on something. When I was a corporal sergeant putting in for this officer program, I had a colonel. He was a 30-some-year infantry officer, and I looked up to him, and I asked him what he had majored in, and he had majored in English. And it just absolutely blew my mind to see this pronounced officer who was now teaching military science. And, you know, he said, if you can speak and you can write coherently, then you can do anything. And so I really took that with me kind of going into school.
So I just went down that path. So you got to be pretty impressed with me right now.
Yeah.
You're supposed to say yes. That was your cue to say, of course,
yes,
Mac.
Yes,
of course.
Yes, yes.
How does the Marine Corps get on your radar? So you enlist out of high school. How does it get on your radar?
Well, let's see. I was dating a guy who was out of high school, and we drove by. He saw the recruiters. office and we went in. I was 16 at the time. I couldn't be recruited, but
right.
I heard everything. And they took my boyfriend 2 weeks later. I was like, what just happened? And so I learned through the process of him going to boot camp, what was going on. I was big into sports and athletics. I'd lived overseas with my family when I was younger, Scotland and Singapore. And it was just all this stuff was culminating, and I just felt like I needed to get out of there. It was a very small town. It was one of those, if you don't leave, you won't leave. And pretty much he was gone, and I saw what was happening with some of my friends around me, and I kind of needed to break out of there. So.
Okay, but there's a lot. There's four services, okay. Why do you join the Marine Corps?
Of course it was the toughest challenge. You know, I went in and I heard the spiel and what all the others were offering. I really liked men back then, and I still really do like guys, and I saw them dress blues, and I was like, those guys are awesome. And so I thought if I could spend more time around them, that might be a good thing.
Right.
That, again, was my 17-year-old mind. Now I look back at it, and it's been amazing. It's been way more of a challenge for me to be in a position where I can really put myself up against some of the toughest and most challenging men and women that I've ever served with. And I don't know. I don't think there was any other choice for me.
All right. So
and my dad was in the Vietnam. My dad was in Vietnam in the Marine Corps, but he didn't talk about any of that. That was before I was born. And I think now, you know, once I said I was going to join, he kind of gave me some insights. But
you don't want to be that girl whose dad is a Marine and she joins the Army, right? I mean, come on.
Right.
Are you are you that kind of a daughter? Come on.
No, I don't think so. Well, my dad was drafted into the Army, and his brother called him from Vietnam and said, hey, you're not going to the Army recruiter with that piece of paper. You're going to the Marine office. And so, you know, there was definitely some influence and persuasion in my on my dad's side of the family.
What was your uncle? Was he in the Army? Was he in the Marine Corps?
Nope, my uncle was in the Marine Corps, older than my dad, and
nice.
He was deployed in Vietnam, and he caught when my dad got a draft notice from the Army. And
wow.
My grandfather got a hold of him and said, hey, you're gonna call your brother and talk to him, and he's like, nope. You're
going to
go Marine, so.
Wow. You know what? I said, you know, you're never as happy that you, at a young age, join the Marine Corps as when you go to war and you see the way the Marine Corps is in combat. It, as you know, it takes your breath away, makes you cry.
Mm-hmm.
That when somebody yells help, Marines don't say, hey, what's going on? Whoa. They come and they'll die. And it's the most intoxicating experience that you can have. And it's been that way for a long, long, long time. And so your uncle hooking your dad up. So, and then ultimately you're the beneficiary. So that's good. Talk to us about deciding to become an officer. So how old were you? What were your thoughts? What was the opportunity? Because that's a pretty good deal if you can become whether, I don't know what program that you used to get commissioned, but some of those programs are awesome.
Yeah. So, I kind of had a interesting route towards that. I was in my early 20s at the time. I had already gone through marriage, having a daughter, very young into the Marine Corps. No one in my family had graduated from college. I only had my mom and dad who had started but not finished. So I felt like there was something pushing me towards kind of advancing my education. I kind of screwed up at the end of high school, so this is my chance to redeem myself and to be a good role model for my daughter. So, I heard about this, MUSEP program after I had been working full time. I went to college, in the evenings full time to get my associate's degree. I put in for the lottery, I guess you can say, for the Marine Corps Enlisted Commissioning Program. Thought they wouldn't choose me because I was a single mom, and, apparently they thought otherwise, and, I got a chance to go, so they, sent me to school full time. I did have Penn State on my radar, but my husband was dating me at the time, and he's from Colorado, and so he was a heavy push towards, you know, the ski slopes and the out ranges to run on, and so he took me there, and it was like a little marketing recruiting thing. So, but it was a interesting transition. I'd say it's been much lonelier on the officer side, not as much camaraderie as I noticed as an enlistee, but on the off side of it is that when I was a junior enlisted, I noticed really good staff NCOs and officers, and I noticed some that I didn't want to be like, and I really felt like I wanted to be there to defend and to advocate for our enlisted Marines, and I felt like I needed to take another step to do that. So that's what I think I've been able to do as an officer. I will say my best friend from boot camp, she's the first one to salute me at my commissioning ceremony in 2004.
Wow.
And the day that she did that, you know, we're sitting there all teary-eyed, and I would have been just as happy to go back as a staff sergeant as I would have been to go back, you know, as a commissioned officer. You don't ever lose that.
Right.
I have a sergeant major at 1MEF, Sergeant Major Castle. Some people might know him. He's amazing.
They might.
I remember talking to him and telling him that when I'm in these staff meetings, I might be a major on my collar, but I'm a sergeant major inside my heart.
Oh!
So, yeah, that's where I'm at, even though, you know, you might be in there, and I'm always thinking about the Marine at the tip of the spear who's going to be impacted by our decisions. So.
So what was your MOS enlisted?
So when I was enlisted, crazily enough, I was a food service specialist for about a year, and then I moved over into the admin personnel field. Definitely a thankless job being a cook in the Corps. Want to shout out to all the cooks listening. Okay, you guys are doing a great service, and I don't know anybody who goes to the field and doesn't appreciate a hot meal. So
We love the cook, but who the hell would want to be one?
It's tough. It's a really tough life. I would say that, you know, someone's got to do it, and there's a lot of tough jobs in the Marine Corps, not just being a cook. And, you know, we just had fun with it. We had fun. We're out in Okinawa in the middle of nowhere, up in freaking Camp Kinzer or something, cooking meals for the infantrymen.
On the edge of the planet, up before everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, back then I was a female Marine, and they didn't know what to do with me. I was one of the few that were out there in the field. They gave me, like, my own, like, general officer tent.
Nice.
And I had to, like, do everything in there. They gave me, like, a bucket of water. They said, that's your bathtub or whatever. But it was cool. You know, I was young, it's that thing about just being a Marine. It's not about where I'm stationed or what job I have or being picky about it. It was just enjoying the fact that I could be a Marine. That was fun.
Okay, so you get commissioned and you become you go public affairs?
That was my first choice. I did have some rudder steer from my staff platoon commander. He's like, I think you'd be a great logo, or let's do some combat engineer stuff. I just knew that public affairs was right up my alley based on my background and my education. And so he went to bat for me, and I was one of the two to get that position. They had two spots available for the whole company. So.
All right. Let me ask you, you obviously get a different view of the Marine Corps. And you get exposed to, you know, much greater issues than the average lieutenant captain does. Give me the greatest challenge that you face or the biggest event that you were ever involved in as a PAO.
That is a very difficult question to answer, mostly because there's so many things that happen within the time frame, and I've been doing that for about 12 and a half years. I'd say probably one of the best times, if I can kind of break it down between best and worst.
Sure.
I'd say one of the best times was, and this is kind of a little, you know, heart jerk kind of thing, but we put together a program for the children of deployed Marines. This was out in Yuma, Arizona. A station out there, bless my heart. And we were trying to figure out a way to get the children to connect a little more and understand what it's like to be deployed, because their moms and dads from the squadrons that were out there were gone. So what we did, we did a full day, and we had it set up. We had tents set up out in the desert. We had them work with the IED robots.
Right.
We had a helicopter that came and did a external lift of all their chow and dropped it for them, and they got a chance to do that. We did land nav. They did gas masks, drills, everything. And just to see their faces and to see how excited they were and to know that they missed their parents. You know, we did little one-on-one videos with the families that allowed us to talk to the kids. And there was a lot of emotion there. These kids who are growing up without their moms and dads while their parents are deployed. And so that was such a good feeling piece there. And then obviously whenever they actually had the homecoming with those families coming back. Now switching to the hard part, everything from hearing about serious incidents every single day. You talk, right. you hear some of it in the news, but we hear about all of the different things. I think the hardest was probably, when I was out in Yuma again, we had two helicopters that collided out over the Chocolate Mountain Aerial Gunnery Range during some training.
Right.
And this was back, I think, in 2012 timeframe. And, we lost all of the Marines that were on those helicopters. And, I think dealing with the fact that the media don't want to slow down and understand that there's a family involved and that we want to give them privacy and time. You know, we had things like Marines standing outside the doors of families to protect them from media that were hounding them and trying to get answers. We had, you know, 5-6 hour press briefings with media there just asking questions and wanting to inform the world, which is important. But also trying to balance that with trying to ensure that we're not giving out any information that's going to that will go against the investigation that was still obviously in its infancy.
Right.
And then things like the helicopters from San Diego flying over the crash site, things like that were just despicable.
Right.
And you want to find that news agency and just chew them out and say, what the hell are you doing there? There are deceased members of our military who were there, and we're trying to do our respect.
After you beat the shit out of them, right? And then you can explain
why
you just beat the shit out of you.
I'm glad this
is all Marine radio. It's our tribe, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. You know, and we've seen, you know, and we see that, you know, again, it's a story that repeats itself over and over and over again. And it's, you know, singularly frustrating. I'll give you a more recent example, and this is how, actually this is the first time I crossed paths, that Stacy and I crossed paths. There was Major Norton when he had his incident up in, 29 Palms. That's how I contacted one FPAO, and I don't know if Stacy and I had already, if Stacy and I had already crossed paths, but anyway, I said, could somebody come on and just explain the basics? Look, mm-hmm. We've done this before. You're talking to your friends, you know, but could somebody explain the basics? She said, sure, I will. And I want to say within 24 hours of the incident, a former Marine at the Washington Post, I wouldn't even say his name, reported that the aircraft broke up prior to impact. You know, and so,
right.
And so, you read that and the things that Stacy's saying about, there's a family that I'm sure, you know, there's a squadron. Where did that come from? Who was watching on night vision goggles that could have seen such a thing and then would pick up the phone from 29 Palms and call a reporter at the Washington Post? And did he have a second source that validated, or did he just take whatever he got and put it in the Washington Post for worldwide dissemination? And just, you know, and the fact that he's a former Marine just to me made my blood boil. And then ultimately in the investigation,
in the investigation,
guess what they don't find in the investigation? The aircraft was intact when it impacted. And guess what never happened, which is a retraction and an apology from that guy. So it's just the frustration that you guys experience of this breathless media that, you know, racing to get some bit of information so that they can have the top click story on their website. To me, it must be incredibly frustrating and not frustrating, probably a nice word. It must make you angry to watch it, knowing that there is real people on the other side and trying to do this thing the right way.
Yeah, and it was tough in Afghanistan. I didn't bring up any of the time of working in this field there, but just not just dealing with, so here you're dealing with mostly U.S. national media, but to just multiply the complexities with different languages, different countries that are reporting different agendas in the way that they report on information, and take that over into Afghanistan, and then they're all reporting out to their own countries, or right. even if it might be the Afghan media. So, you know, we had many, many times where even for us on the ground, it was difficult for us to be able to provide that accurate information out, because by the time it was translated through all those different voices and different agendas, it gets out. And I think that kind of speaks to what we're going through right now with the whole fake news or disinformation and the way things get twisted. It's becoming more and more complex for people to be able to really believe what they're hearing. And I always tell people, go straight to the source. Don't listen to a third party news commentator if you can. If it's a speech, go listen to the speech. If it's a press release that's being regurgitated by CNN or Fox News, go read the press release. And I'm not discounting those news agencies.
No, feel free to, because most of the stuff they put out is crap, honestly. I mean, it is, to me, just everybody should remember, it's a for-profit business, all right? And those people get paid by the number of people that visit those websites that view that. So what you're going to see is the hottest and the shrillest views. And so it's interesting you say that, because I have a penchant for when the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff testifies, we play it in its entirety here, 2 hours.
Exactly.
You don't need to read the story. Listen to him. What he says is what they're doing. Trust me. Yesterday's press conference by General Dunford. Don't listen to what anybody writes about Niger. Listen to what he says. He is the burning bush in terms of this kind of stuff. If he says it, you can take it to the bank. Because you could put a gun to Joe Dunford's head, tell him to lie, and he'll look at you and say, pull the trigger, because I won't do it. And so I agree, absolutely. Go to the source documents. Don't waste your time on, and this is just me, and I cover the news all the time, on some of the garbage. I want to pitch an idea to you. Tell me what you think.
Mm-hmm.
It's a website called the Credible News Network, or something like that. It's a Drudge Report style, but it's vetted by disabled veterans who are journalism majors, and they only use credible sources on this website. Writers and reporters that have been vetted, that are known not to speculate, that stay in their lanes, and they do quality reporting as a place where you can come to read articles about national topics, yet not have to deal with the shrill nature of the news reporting that we see most often. What do you think? Good idea? Bad idea? Would you click on it once? Would you click on it once?
I would take a look at it. So in a perfect world, it sounds amazing. I think that people are still going to want to look at it with an eye with a bit of scrutiny.
Okay, so we have to prove ourselves.
Yeah, so I think proving yourself, I think also being able to set yourself apart from the It Bleeds, It Leads headlines and the way that information is distributed. Unfortunately, people have become so numb to things that the news agencies seem to have to rev it up and make it a little more dramatic for people to even click on it. But I think it would be a great site, and actually if it would be a site that would provide audio transcript links to for people just to have one place to get. So if you're going to report on something that's recent, go ahead and provide those substantiating documents there. So people, if you guys are going to discuss around it, that's great. But just allow people to have those things right there with it.
At it. The source document, right? And, footnoted.
Yeah, and audio is huge. Podcasting, people can drive, go to the gym, do whatever they need. Cut the grass while they're listening. Those are, I think, becoming more and more crucial as we multitask in our lives.
All right. My guest this morning is, when did you retire, Stace?
Officially, October 1st.
October 1st, recently retired. Major or Lieutenant Colonel?
Major.
Major Stacey Reidinger. And are you working these days?
So as of right now, I've enjoyed my time off. I purposefully wanted to have some time to breathe and kind of get to know who I am a little bit more
yeah.
and see what I gravitate toward. So I am, I've been working towards my first Ironman, which is in November.
Mm.
And I'm going to do my Ironman Arizona. That's been on my goal list for a while. And then, yeah, I've got a couple of things in the bag here. I don't want to let it all out. But I'm definitely in the media, news industry / field of communication. I'll be moving on in that realm, maybe some entrepreneurship type of thing. So, yeah, it's exciting.
All right. We need to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about your recent deployment with Team Rubicon, which, for those people who don't know, is a very cool organization. If you watch the World Series, you're going to see, I believe you'll see, T-Mobile is raising money and either matching donations or they're doing stuff with Team Rubicon. So very cool stuff. And I want to talk to you about hazing, if you don't mind. Is that all right?
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right. We'll continue. My guest, recently retired Marine Major, former public affairs officer at OneMeth, Stacy Reidinger. More of All Marine Radio on a Tuesday coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the group can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOF community should be aware of.
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Morning.
805 on the West Coast. Good morning to you. Echoing the words of Smash Mouth right there. Joining me from the San Diego area is Stacy Reidinger, recently retired major, prior enlisted major, I might add, a Mustang, and training for an Ironman. But also just got done helping out Team Rubicon, so wanted to have her on and talk about it. So for people that don't know, Stacy, about Team Rubicon, tell everybody what Team Rubicon is.
Yeah, so Team Rubicon is a nonprofit disaster response organization that was actually founded by some veteran Marine who had actually ventured out into Haiti. After a disaster that was there and started to kind of offer their help and noticed that there weren't many organizations out there that were just focused in on doing some of the nitty gritty aspects of things like demolition and, you know, tearing down things and really, getting down to the basics of helping people get their lives back. And so, since that time, I don't exactly remember when they kicked off. Since then, they've been doing operations here in the U.S. as well as overseas. And just recently, I was, fortunate enough to join the team, do some of my emergency response training online before joining, and I went out to help with Hurricane Harvey.
And so Hurricane Harvey in the Houston area, and so was it easy for you to get plugged into them? So what's the path? Because to me, the kind of work you're talking about makes sense to a lot of veterans, and it is the best we see of our nation in the midst of all the craziness that we see on TV, that I think is a very small part of the nation. When you see a disaster, you see whole states and regions of the country come together and start pushing in one direction, and the people that go to support that in efforts like Team Rubicon, certainly emblematic of that. Was it easy to plug into and get mobilized to go help?
Yeah, it was. And I actually had signed up for them about 4 years ago. I had received an email. I had some people kind of tell me about it. And I had been too busy with deployments and stuff with the Marine Corps to actually participate. I had donated to them. And so, what really happened to me for Houston hit home. I have family that was impacted out there. I was loading my car up. And I was heading that way. So I drove from San Diego all the way out to first hitting the outskirts of Houston where I could get in. I had family that was flooded out there, my aunt, my grandmother, my niece. And then further up, closer to Beaumont, I had my sister and my sister's daughter. All their homes were flooded. So I was heading out, and I knew about Team Rubicon. I started to hear about them in the news. I was listening to Houston Matters, their webcast. And I'm like, you know what? I'm signed up for this thing. What do I need to do? So I went and called them, and I got information. I looked online, and I got all my training done between San Diego and Houston. Mm-hmm. Now, everything, a lot of their stuff's on the line. You can listen to it. I don't get your training done, but it was very easy to get it done. You can get most of the training done. It's all the basic stuff's online. Now, they do have specialty areas where they need someone that might be a heavy equipment operator, somebody that can handle chainsaws, do stuff like that. So, and obviously people who have a paramedic, first responder, that stuff helps. So by the time I got there, the teams that were out doing search and rescue were closing up pretty much. I remember pulling up to a place in Beaumont, and that's where I was helping. They even break everything up into, like, military-style names. It was FOB Beaumont. And I'm like, this is cool, because I'm like, I understand this. I understand this model. This is like, right. This is like freaking military deployment for real. I get there. They had some of the small, like, recon boats, the rubber boats that were still out with the boat, trailers. And we were transitioning at the time. They have their own operations center and everything. We were transitioning when I got there from search and rescue to actual more stability ops stuff, which would include going in, assessing the damage in the homes that were flooded, which was the majority of what these people were displaced from, and then deciding, okay, how are we going to get in there? Are we going to gut the house? What's going on? So, it was exciting. I got there and I was like with the first team in Beaumont to go out. And we did a firehouse. They need to get the firehouse back and running because, I mean, that's essential with all the electricity problems that were happening. And
right.
We went in. We did several people's homes, from elderly, older people. We had lots of veterans that we were helping as a part of it. And one thing I wanted to mention is that it wasn't just military people. They actually take anyone. So if you go online and you're able to support them in some capacity with your expertise, they'll take you. So you can be someone that you never got to join the military, but you want to go serve with some former military, this is it. And it's very welcoming. They had everything. They had a church was providing us bed down areas. They had chow for us every meal. We had vehicles for us to get out. We had our vehicles loaded up with all the tools, the wheelbarrows, all of the equipment you can think of vetting a house. Everything was there, our safety equipment, our eye protection, our breathing mask, everything. And it was just awesome. And you get there, you go do a hard day's of work, you come back, you power wash all your crap off, and then you go sit by a bonfire around 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and you just get to talk to people and get to know each other. And it was absolutely amazing. I highly recommend it for anybody. There were active duty people out there, too. I actually had some active duty people I know recently. They're like, I have never deployed. I'd love to go do this. I feel like I've kind of been in training and exercise mode, but there's no chance for me to go to Iraq or Afghanistan or anything. And I'm like, hey, you should see if you can do something, you know, see if you can take leave for a week if they need you and go do this. So, yeah.
Did you have to, so you got yourself there. Or would they pay for you to fly there if you had, or do you have to get yourself there?
Yeah. So what happened was that I was already on mission. You know, my sister sent a message. She said our house is flooding out, and that was like with her the 15th family member with all the kids counting that were going to be out of home. So I was like, I got to get on the road. So I drove myself and I paid for all of that, and I got there. What they were doing, though, since I got there, was that 2 weeks later they had chartered a flight. American Airlines went ahead and comped for that and flew a group of Team Rubicon members from Los Angeles directly into Houston, and that was paid for. That was taken care of. And then since then they've done flights out of Denver. They've done flights out of the East Coast. So, and they do reimbursement if you're within 450 miles of the disaster area. They are willing to do reimbursement for ground travel. I'm guessing potentially for air travel, but yeah, they very, very, very smooth, tight ship, closely resembling any time I've been out doing a military exercise or I've been deployed. I mean, it's run very well, and they have a centrally organized higher headquarters that's there in Dallas. That's like their bigger EOC connected with FEMA. So we're not talking about small cheese here. We're talking about professional operation that in my mind is the closest that I've seen to kind of being back out with the military.
The if you want to check out the website, it's called TeamRubiconUSA.org. And if you check out the board of directors, and again, this organization is started by two former Marines, and it's just grown into something that's absolutely incredible, honestly. And David Petraeus, you know, part of their team, and on their board. Mm-hmm. And so it's those kind of people with Wall Street backing, and these guys have built this as a vision to help veterans, and also to help communities, and linking up people who love to give and find incredible fulfillment, yet might be in a dark place in their life, as they struggle to make sense of some of the things they've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan or wherever they've been, and also but with this incredible appetite to serve and to help. And so they've helped a lot of veterans. They've helped a lot of people on active duty. They've also helped a lot of people that were in tremendous need. And so it's just a pretty incredible organization. And so fun to have you on, Stacy, who is somebody who's actually deployed with them, and to hear how good they are. I even smiled when you said FOB, whatever it was, because it is. It's like going into somebody's office and they have their I Love Me wall up, and you walk in, you're like, yeah, this is my tribe. I'm home. I get that. I have an I Love Me wall. And it's just the things that are familiar and make you feel warm and good and whatnot. So, so very, very, very cool. Anything that you'd like to share with us about Team Rubicon, the experience that I haven't asked you?
The only other thing I'd like to say is that, if anyone's ever, anyone that's listening has been in the military or served with those in the military, and you know how they, we carry around this sense of pride and purpose, most of us, and I would hope that everybody did have that. But that sense you wake up every morning, you're like, I've got a mission, I've got something to live for, and there's people that need me. That's how I felt when I was out there. And it wasn't just the people we were going to help, because I'm telling you, we were going in and people were crying and people were so upset. I mean, they were so distraught. Everything they owned was laid out in their front yard. People had lost family members. They'd lost pets, and we're there for them to just cry on our shoulders. But it was also because we had men and women who had either served or, had been through some other things in their lives who were finally regaining that sense of purpose that they lost when they left the military. And, you know, me kind of being on terminal leave, I hadn't quite retired yet, I was kind of in this middle area, and I was seeing all this happen, and it was just a beautiful thing, that through giving, they were receiving. Through them giving of themselves and being there, and being tired. I mean, you're so freaking tired at the end of the day. I mean, you could barely lift your arms, you've been pulling out nails and ripping down drywall all day. It didn't matter. We all came back, we're all dirty, our boots are covered in crap, and we just have a beer, and we just sit down, and it didn't matter about, there's no ranks there. I mean, there's billets and stuff like that, but it's just like a normalizer. And it was amazing. I remember leaving, and they're like, hey, you're going to have kind of the blues for a little bit. It's going to be like when you get home from deployment. I'm like, hell no. There's no way this is going to feel like after leaving Afghanistan and being there for 13 months. But, you know, they were right, because, I mean, when we got there, it was kind of like when you go camping and you're away from everything, and the phones aren't, you're not looking at your phone, and everybody's just engaged. It's like that. And it was like day on. And then when you leave, you're kind of detaching from that again. So what they do with Team Rubicon is they have regions all over the country. So I've got a region 9 here in San Diego, or here in the West Coast. And then I've got sub-regional groups here in San Diego. So the other day they sent an email, hey, let's go have a beer. Let's go meet at this club. Let's go talk. And so there's like these little tribes all over the country that you can connect with when you're not out doing missions. So it's an awesome organization. I definitely plan to support them through advocacy or whatever I can. I'd love to go out and support again, maybe if they still need us up in California. I just got a mission notice. What they do is, like, now that I'm on the roster and I'm qualified, I get an email. It's literally like an email or a text. They say, hey, we got a mission. We need you to go. Are you ready? Can you pack your bags? And then I click through a couple things, And before you call it, they'll send me a message back and say, hey, you need to be on a 24-hour tether. We are going to let you know when you're ready to go, and then I'll get the email in, and then they'll say, go to the San Diego airport or, you know, be here at 0800 or whatever. It's really, really cool. I hope that they can expand as needed. Obviously, you know, their disaster response, you can't necessarily plan for all the disasters.
Right.
But there's going to be many, many months. People need to go out to Houston, go out to Puerto Rico, go out to Northern California. They have missions in all those places right now. If you go to their website, they have like a whole map of the U.S., and they also have international stuff going on. You can go in there and you can see where all of the current operations are happening. So if you're feeling kind of like, why am I doing this? You're kind of feeling like you had a lot of training in the military, but you didn't get to use it. Or you're just wanting to kind of get a deployment experience that you haven't had. Or maybe you served overseas, but you never served at home. A lot of us do a crap overseas and do stuff in the Philippines, and we go do humanitarian aid. But I mean, that was so awesome to have a woman cry on my shoulder for 30 minutes and tell me she didn't even know if she wanted to stay alive anymore because her house was gone. Her husband had died 3 months ago. She just felt so low. And I was at home helping somebody. I was at home. I was in America. So I really think that people should find their way to help. And there's other organizations that need volunteers. But this one is just extremely fit for those of us coming from the military kind of structure. It marries up very nicely.
And let me tell you, they're in Latin America, they're in South America, they're in Ecuador, they're in Chile, they're in Africa. They're in Greece. I know it looks like Greece, Macedonia. They're in Turkey. They're in Pakistan. They're in Nepal. They're in 4 different places in Africa. So they're in the Philippines. They're in, it looks like, either Thailand or Burma. So if you want to deploy, Team Rubicon can help you. But I think the biggest thing that it does, especially relative to veterans, is, as you said, it restores that sense of purpose that a lot of people look for and they don't find in civilian life. And so I think it's a big part of mental health, and I think an enabler in terms of figuring out where do I want to ultimately go. Can I find an organization where I could do this for a living, you know, and I think it's certainly an enabler to a better place. And so all the different things that they do now around the world, it's amazing. And it's Marine owned and operated. Well, maybe not owned anymore, but it's Marine originated, so we're all proud of that. I want to switch gears, if you don't mind, and ask you about hazing. It's been one of the kind of the horizontal themes, big article over the course of the last couple of weeks in Marine Corps Times about issues in the 1st Marine Division and Major General Smith tackling or taking it head on, probably while you were still on active duty, the whole issue of hazing. I'm curious, as a prior enlisted officer, your thoughts on how do you stop hazing? And I'm not prior enlisted, but people thought I was, which gives you some sense of how cool of an officer I was. So if you could imagine that, like, hey, sir, were you prior enlisted? Nah, I'm just really cool.
Oh, you thought you were getting props when they hear that. Huh?
Are you kidding me? That's the greatest compliment you could get as an officer. So were you prior enlisted? Nah, man, I'm just really cool. They're like, oh, damn, I can't believe we asked him that. So I'm curious, my take, hazing, I mean, officers can stand up and talk about it. But when we talk about it, what they hear is, wah, wah, wah. And I know people will say, no, it's a Marine Corps and we're all in this together. To me, until you can get, I think corporal is a little bit of a novice to put an end to something that has powerful roots in young people, is a little bit of a novice. Although they can, and we'd love to see them do it, I think it's tough. The rank of sergeant and staff sergeant to me are the key. But who do you put pressure on to get them to be involved? And I've asked people, where you see a strong platoon sergeant that says, this ain't happening, everybody look at me and shake their head, nod their head, right? then it tends not to happen in those organizations. So to me, there's certain places that you need to put pressure on if you ultimately want to impact this. As I've thought about it, and I've thought about it a lot, I'm curious about your thoughts. How, if you were the commoner, what would you do? How do you, and knowing that, look, it's a problem in our society, so you're not going to get it to zero. But so this happens on an exceptional basis, not as often as I believe it's happening today in the Marine Corps. How do you do it?
All right. So as you were talking, I had a flood of memories back in 1994, 95-ish. Remember when we had all the blood wings and crap that was kind of hitting the news? And you know, before that had happened, I had already been in the Marine Corps, and I had already experienced what I thought was indoctrination into certain key aspects of Marine Corps culture, but were actually hazing. You know, things like, oh, you know, you're going to get your blood stripes. So, you know, there's things that happen. And back then, being a junior Marine, I wanted that acceptance. I obviously I didn't want the pain that was coming along with some of the things that were going on and the things we were doing. I didn't like it. I thought it was kind of stupid. I thought it was immature, but at the same time, I wanted to be accepted. So, now that I look at it flash forward many, many years and I've seen it go in all different directions, I've even seen some really, really, really small things, blow up that you and I might question. We're like, is that really hazing or is that just, you know, somebody joking around? But it just comes down to human dignity. And I think part of this is something that's learned and it's indoctrinated day one at boot camp, or it's indoctrinated during, training. I know that enlisted boot camp training is different than officer candidate school and the basic school. There's differences in the way that we're trained. But when it comes down to what we're trained at that basic school, the mentality and the way that the drill instructors, the way that they break us down, I understand the whole process of, you know, trying to break you down so you don't see yourself as an individual, you see yourself as a team, and you have to work as a team in order to accomplish things. That's great. But there is a level of human dignity, respect for another human, and zero defect mentality. Zero defect mentality has been something that's been the buzz the whole time I've been in for 24 years. And it's been something that's been ingrained in me. Perfectionism. You must do things correctly the first time. You will be punished. There will be some type of negative circumstance if you do something wrong. If you look at the business world, the way that people succeed and innovate is because they make mistakes over and over again. They make calculated mistakes, and they make mistakes that they learn from, but they aren't badgered to the point where they're so afraid to do anything because they don't want to make a mistake. And I see that being a part of the culture issue with the hazing. The other aspect is that, you know, we're not just seeing it in the Marine Corps and the military. We're seeing it's been happening across the sororities and the fraternities for years in college, which is the same type of age group that these young men and women that we mostly see it happening with. So there's some couple of issues. I'd say figure out what needs to be said early on when you've got them in the scare mode at boot camp or OCS. And the second thing is that power and control can breed to corruption, and it can breed to people who feel like they have ultimate power over someone else. And there's been many studies in colleges and universities. You can look at all the psychological, sociological studies that talk about whether you're a prison guard and you're over prisoners, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, we place 18, 19, 20-year-olds in leadership positions who are still themselves trying to grow up, right, and we give them a sense of power and control. That's dangerous. Not that we shouldn't do it, but that's a heavy responsibility. And what I see them doing with it in some ways, whether it be a behavior they learned when they were a kid, hey, this is what happened to me, so I'm going to do it to someone else, or they don't know how to correct someone in their deficiencies, and so they turn to violence, or they turn to something that's demeaning and degrading to a human. And it's difficult. It's not something that we're going to correct perfectly, but we have to pay attention to these young men and women we give these responsibilities to. And we put them off in far corners of places where they're being put in a position that they might not be ready for on a maturity level. And then that's when you come up with all these bullshit stuff that happens and you see them, you know, I could list off 100 lists of different things that I've heard that they've done to each other. And I think that that's most of it. Most of it does not seem facetious or in any way, shape, or form of them trying to be an evil person trying to hurt or kill someone. I think most of it is they're just immature and not able to process properly. These people aren't doing what I need them to do. How do I get them proper training? Instead, it's let me punish them in a very, just basic instinct type of way instead of thinking through, okay, long term, if I do this to this person, is it really going to change them? It's going to scare the hell out of them. So that's kind of my thought. Not probably what you're looking for, but that's,
well, let me just refine the question. Okay. So you think in terms of broad social themes, education in a couple different places. One is at boot camp. Two is how they're treated in the operating forces when they leave that school environment and they go out to work. My understanding from talking to SJs that the vast majority of this stuff is conceived and executed by the proverbial senior lance corporal, who in some way, shape, or form went through it, and now it's his turn to be lord of the manor. How do you affect them? Okay, so they've gone through our boot camp. They're now in the operating forces, and they've gone through some rite of either initiation, I enjoyed the initiations I went through. In the Marine Corps. I mean, they weren't sadistic. Some of them, but again, I joined the Marine Corps in 1983, okay? I first saw somebody getting a blood stripe right after the formation there on the blacktop. It's not like they hit it, right? It's not like they went into the barracks and did it. It was part of it. And as you said, you joined the Marine Corps. You wanted to measure up, and if this was part of it, then you accepted it because everybody else had gone through, right? I'm not gonna punk out of that stuff. I'm got promoted today, so have at it, boys. Who do you put pressure on to exert influence over the senior lance corporal? Sergeant major.
I think what we have done and we need to do a little bit more of is making examples of these little assholes that are doing, excuse my language.
We love it. Come on. Bullshit and asshole in the space of 5 minutes, you're warming up to the program.
I remember we used to be pretty open about having the blotter and kind of blasting people out, and now I can't think we have like this oversaturated information environment and people know what the hell's going on, and you might hear about it on Facebook, you might hear it from your friend on Snapchat or whatever, but I don't know, it needs to be more formalized. I like these public NJPs, I like these, let's just put them out there, but I mean that's the tail end, right? Exploiting the thing that's already happened. But if someone's had that happen to them, that could be considered some level of trauma or something like that. But, we've gone round and round in circles with this every time we get new people in and we have to re-educate and help people understand it. But, like I said, it comes down to human dignity. How are the senior leaders, enlisted and officer, how are they treating their Marines? I see junior staff NCOs making big mistakes as well because they themselves are pretty darn young. Some people are getting promoted fast. And so if they're not treating their men and women with dignity, setting that example, and they're not stating clearly that that's not to be condoned, and they're not providing ample education on how to properly correct someone who's deficient in a certain area, the whole thing about ostracizing Marines, too, that's bullshit. Stop ostracizing your Marine. Just because they don't come in and they don't look like, you know, the perfect 6-foot, you know, muscular person that can do, you know, a 300 PFT might be somebody of a different caliber. They freaking volunteered as well. Don't be that person that says, oh, you know, that guy doesn't fit in quite right, so we're just going to pick on him. We're just going to push him into the ground and, you know, find out a way to non-wreck him to lance corporal or do whatever else. Because you know what? You're the punk. Why don't you try to do something even better and build that person up? to try to make them stronger and make them somebody who feels proud to have volunteered to serve their country instead of being a punk who thinks that it's better to put somebody down. So, I don't know, I just...
The Marine Corps is filled with those, with people looking to prove something. And we've always been like that. Whether it was, you know, a way to avoid jail and you're trying to straighten yourself out, or, you know, I'm 5'4" and I'm going to prove to everybody that I'm a badass. The Marine Corps is filled with it. I agree with you. The people that don't see that and put that down, challenge them. And trust me, 99% of the time, they'll answer the challenge, because the person that looks at the propaganda the Marine Corps puts out, somebody asked me, you know, people ask you over the course of years, what makes the Marine Corps different? What makes the Marine Corps different is the people that join, and that you go and you listen to these different pitches from different services, and trust me, the Marine Corps pitch is pretty different. Right. And then when you're looking at it on online and you watch movies and you see, you know, posters of, you know, that say, we don't promise you shit, with the drill instructor looking down. I mean, you see all this stuff. There's no other service gives you that flavor. So the person, especially in today's culture, that looks at that and says, I'll try that, that's a different human being than the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are a corporation like that. And when you see that corporation challenged, it's pretty cool to watch it get after it when you see it challenged. And so, to me, young leaders that don't understand it, this is why, to me, my solution is a mandatory Section I comment that says hazing took place in this sergeant, this staff sergeant, this lieutenant. If you see that everywhere this person goes, then you can judge it. There's no editorial comment attached to it, because they may or may not be, if they were culpable in it, it would certainly be amplified. But until you hold higher people accountable, because, for instance, the Lance Corporals are getting court-martialed now. Well, where's everybody else? Where's everybody else? I would submit, you know, you can court-martial in onesies and twosies at Parris Island, but without the CO being relieved and the sergeant major going with them, that message didn't get sent. Okay, well, those guys got in trouble, but I'm good. You know, I stood up there and I read what I was supposed to. That doesn't follow through with everything your unit does or fails to do, which is your responsibility, and the one question court martial, which is, were you in charge on this date? Yes, I was. Okay, that's all we need. Thank you. You're done. And so, to me, without that accountability, then you're just going to, there's going to continue to be the cycle of wah, wah, wah. And then if the staff NCOs are largely silent on it, that silent, in my opinion, is consent. That enables. They've got to be in, and they've got to be all in, and they've got to talk about and mentor. This is why we don't do it. I had it done to me. Don't do it to anybody else. And until you can get the institution to be doing that, then I think you're going to have it. So that leads me to this question, and we'll end with this. Is hazing a problem or a symptom of a problem?
I think it's a symptom. I don't think that hazing is in itself, because I would kind of break it up into at least two categories. I see the hazing part of the ritual, that goes along with different benchmarks that you reach in the military. And then the other part I see is, because of that warrior culture, that we are the few, the proud, the toughest, we try to weed people out. And I see hazing being a part of that. It's almost as if, you know, I don't want that guy on my six, because he's not going to cover me when I need him. And so it's almost like a survival of the fittest kind of thing that kind of emerges. And, you know, in some ways, that's got to be said for too. And I will defend some of the people I know who have been in some pretty interesting positions where I was pretty darn angry at them, at the way that they were handling things with a junior Marine. But at the same time, gosh darn it, get that Marine out of the Corps. Right. He does not need to be here. And there are some people that make it in, and then they get stuck. They're there. We can't get rid of them. And you know, God bless them. They joined the Corps, and I'm glad they did. They tried it out. But you know what? Everybody doesn't stay with the NFL. Everybody doesn't stay. You know, you don't just stay on a sports team because you got there, and now you got a contract and you stay. There has to be a way, potentially, for the military to have a fast lane to admin separate or to push out some of these people who just do not, who do not live up to
assimilate.
What they do. Yeah, they don't assimilate.
But again, we're going the other way, though, Stacey. And you and I have both lived it. I mean, I never was part of a forest preservation board until I got to, I was the OPSO at One Meth Headquarters Group. And I sat on that forest preservation board. And you look at some of the Marines that come in front of you, not they, but their files, and you look and say, how are we going to get this person to be full-up round deployable, another widget in the system, in the span of an enlistment? These problems, depression, alcoholism, sexual assault, how are we going to – this person is never going to be able to do to live under the stress that we force Marines to live under. And we seem to be trending to try to save people that clearly don't fit. And I don't know, maybe there is an element of that. And then what happens is, you know, they're a special project and other Marines are doing their work, and that gets old after a while because they're not pulling their share. And Marines can be, you know, you lived in the tribe. If you don't pull your share of the load, Marines can be brutal. And so
I would say that force preservation board piece, I'm glad that it's there. I think that it gets the right people around the table to discuss something.
Right.
But I'm telling you what, that's the back end of it. Okay. We need to focus more on the front end. We need to focus on not getting them into the force. We need to focus on what we need to do to have our Marines not be briefed in a force preservation board. And that means really getting to understand what's happening with them and understanding that everybody's different and they all have different stressors, pressure points, personal things in their lives. And it's tough to do that as a leader.
Right.
It's really tough because it means you're probably not going to get as much time with your family. You're not going to get as much stuff done during the day. But that's not what we're paid for. We're there to help mentor, train, and develop them, to help them reach their potential and to veer them away from the things that happen when you're tired and you're exhausted and you just don't know how to get it all done in a day. And we're older and we've been through things and we're more resilient and we're a little tougher. That's what you're there for. You can get the other paperwork stuff done and go chop out those fit reps later in the evening, but there's got to be something more. You got to care about the Marines as they're coming through and think about them. What was I like when I was 19? What was I like when I was 22 right out of college? What are those factors that are living in their lives outside of them being able to just do what they need to do for the Marine Corps? All the stuff the Marine Corps makes you do that has nothing to do with your job. That's what you should be grinding on and caring about and thinking about as a leader. And I think that makes them feel, they feel it if they know that you care. They feel it and some of them may still need a little bit help along the way and you may still need to get the Force Preservation Board, but that should be like, that's like the last place that you really want to end up having your Marines. It's put there for a purpose because we know over time that we've had issues and we need to get the right people around the table to discuss a strategic plan on how to help someone get back to full steam. But it's not a solution. That's just like okay, we're here, so let's not make it any worse.
Well, no, you're right. And really, as officers, you sit around and discuss, wait a minute, why does this even exist? Are they that deficient in what they're doing in that battalion that this has to be convened at the regimental, this kind of oversight has to be convened at the regimental level? And so it's the Marine Corps sensitivity to issues like suicide and things like that. And that sees, you know, the need to create this and exercise that oversight. But at the end of the day, it's about leadership. It's about leadership. So anyway, Stacey, first of all, thanks for coming on and doing this. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I hope wherever you go in the future, keep us posted. And I hope you don't mind if we have leadership roundtables and things like that I give you a call.
That sounds great, Mike. Thank you for having me, and thank you for having this radio show. I think it's phenomenal, and I'll try to promote it as much as I can.
Well, I'm going to hold you to that, so and I'm going to check to make sure you do that. Anyway, my guest this morning, recently retired, former prior enlisted Major Stacy Reitinger. And Stacy, good luck. Be careful of the snakes out there in power.
Thank you. Semper Fi.
All right. Semper Fidelis. We're going to take a break. Yeah, the whole hazing thing, tough. And I don't know that there's one solution to it. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.